There will be confusion on a massive scale. People will be unable to communicate or navigate. Power will be out temporarily. Once communications are reestablished at great expense, we will broadcast a message to the world's leaders demanding an international conference to dismantle the instruments of globalization. For starters, we will call for immediate steps to disband the World Bank and the WTO. And if they don't do what we ask? I don't think that will be a problem. We will point out the fragility of the global infrastructure and suggest that even if they rebuild, it will be a simple matter to destroy it again. We can play topsy-turvy with the magnetic poles for as long as they like. Margrave grinned. How does it feel to be one of the gods on Mount Olympus? Gant took a sip of his drink. Intoxicating. But even the gods have house-cleaning matters. This is why we must deal with Kurt Austin, the Numa man. I think he should be taken out. I thought we were going to watch and wait on Austin to see if he developed into a threat. He is a threat. When Austin first came into the picture, I looked into his background. He's a marine engineer and salvage expert with Numa, who has been involved in some high-profile missions. Doyle learned that he lived in a house on the Potomac and conducted electronic surveillance of the place. Did he come up with anything useful? Gant responded with a reptilian smile. He hit the jackpot. Austin had a meeting at his house with several people to discuss the sinking of the Southern Belle. He's been aboard our sunken transmitter vessel that apparently surfaced momentarily and has connected it to the setup he saw on Barrett's boat. He knows the significance of the Kovacs theorems as well. Gant waited for his words to sink in. The blood had been drained from Margrave's saturnine face. "This is a disaster," he said. "What do we do?" "I'd suggest that you do everything you can to expedite the technical end of the project." Inside the cave, Carla was right behind her godfather. She saw him falter and went to his aid.
"Are you all right, Uncle Carl?"
"I cracked my head back there at the cave entrance. Probably suffered a slight concussion."
"Maybe we should stop and rest," Carla said.
Schroeder flashed his light ahead and saw a low ledge projecting from the wall. He sat down with his back against the wall and closed his eyes. But his respite was short-lived. Muffled voices could be heard coming from the passageway they had just passed through. Schroeder was on his feet instantly. He whispered to Carla to turn the flashlight off. They stood in the darkness and listened. As the voices grew louder, they became more distinct. Men could be heard speaking in Russian. Putting his aches and pains aside, Schroeder took the lead again. The passageway went down at a shallow angle for a few hundred feet before leveling out. Carla was the first to see the cleft in the wall. Schroeder had been so intent on putting distance between them and their pursuers that he had walked by the wrinkle in the limestone where the wall folded in on itself, creating a narrow opening little more than a foot wide and 5 feet tall. Schroeder's first instinct was to keep going. The hole could be a death trap. He stuck his head through and saw that the tunnel actually widened after a few feet. He told Carla to wait, and he walked for 50 paces or so along the main cave. He placed his flashlight on the floor as if it had been dropped in haste. The voices were getting louder. He went back to where Carla was waiting, squeezed his tall body through the cleft, then helped Carla through. They kept moving until they found a place where the cave curved slightly. He flattened his back against the wall and drew his pistol. The first man through the hole would be dead. They could see the ghostly glow of lights from the main tunnel. The ivory hunters passed the crevice. Seconds later, there was an excited yell. They had seen the flashlight. The voices receded.